Welcome to Alienating the Audience, a show that explores the deeper side of science fiction. I'm Andrew Heaton, the thinking man's nerd, and today we're going to explore space-time, or at least the contents of an old British police box, because we're going to dive into Doctor Who. Justin Robert Young, thank you for coming on the program.
Oh, Andrew, I certainly haven't been upset that I've never been on this show before, and I'm certainly not already still holding a grudge that I've appeared so late in the run.
Uh-huh. Well, okay, so in my defense, I try very hard to compartmentalize all of my friends and make them as unidimensional and one-note as possible. You're one of my political friends. You're the host of Politics, Politics, Politics. I can't help if this is the first I've heard that you have interests outside of that field.
No, that's fine. I, you know, it's just all my other friends were on it, and you know, like I'm the podcast guy, so like it's fine. Look, we're here for an important reason, which is to discuss Doctor Who, and it's something that I have complicated feelings on, and I actually feel like we're probably going to be more aligned on, because I'm glad that you've watched some of the product now that we can discuss it.
Yeah, well, and like good job on starting me off on the right foot. So for listeners to know this, I am not that familiar with Doctor Who. I am in fact very unfamiliar with Doctor Who. In the cursory research I did, there are at this moment 862 episodes. I have seen two and. I think I've seen four episodes of the 862, so I am by no means that educated in it. And today I am going to talk to you, Justin, about what constitutes Doctor Who, and for people that, like me, are listening that are unfamiliar with it, what they ought to keep an eye out for and why it's worth watching. And I have to say, you kicked it off in a great way, because you suggested two episodes to me, Blink and Heaven Sent. The former has David Tennant, the latter has Capaldi in it. They were fantastic.
Yeah.
And I the previous times that I've attempted to do Doctor Who, because for years my British friends would say that I would love Doctor Who, and I kind of looked like a Craigslist version of David Tennant, and like, you know, I really should like, I would. And so the first time I tried watching it from the very beginning, so I picked like whatever super cornball British 1962 episode existed, which was not how to get it off. And then they're like, no, you did it wrong. You got to start with the new stuff. So I started with the 2005 short-haired Northern Englishman in leather jacket, which was also super cornball. And so I was like, I guess I'm too cynical at this point in my life to enjoy this program. The episodes you sent me, however, I was like, these were charming and very well written, very clever. They kind of reminded me of, like, it was sort of like British Outer Limits, except with recurring characters.
You know, now that you mention it, you kind of do look like the bottom half of your face is David Tennant, but the top head, you have the forehead of Matt Smith. So, like, there, you do have a very it is kind of shocking that you're not into Doctor Who, because you
have I am a grab bag of Doctor Who components. Just if you were to have a trunk of dead or retired British actors and shook them all up and plucked me out of it. Yeah, no, when I was living in Edinburgh, occasionally, because I was clean shaven at the time, like occasionally, like kids would call me Dr. What, because they like they'd see me, that they hear me talk, and they're like, you're like the American Doctor Who, or like wherever I was visiting at the time. And I was like, all right,
Doctor, agreed.
I wish that I'd gotten into this when I was a kid, because I feel like I see good stuff in Doctor Who, but I feel like my sci-fi life would have been richer if I had really got into Doctor Who. I feel like when I was a young teenager or a tween,
you know,
I feel like that's kind of the ideal time. And then I could have already seen all 862 episodes.
So let me be clear for all the purists, because this is a nerd's nerd show. Let me announce the fact that I am not a connoisseur of the pre-reboot canonical, you know, Tom Baker Doctor Who. Like, I am a fan exclusively, and we'll talk with expertise exclusively about the post reboot version of it, which showed up some point in the aughts. That being said, for me, to love Doctor Who is to be either frustrated or delighted by it. Like, there, and I think to a certain extent that is part of what is baked into it, because I do think that at its best, it is this monster of the week kind of series. And the best times where it's really sung is when you don't realize that it's building a longer story, and then it kind of pops up. There's a reason why, and one of the greatest what ifs in science fiction history was at the point that Doctor Who was a dead IP in the late 90s, as Fox was having such a gigantic run with science fiction stuff like X-Files and Sliders, and they were really, really diving into more and more science fiction stuff. There is a pilot for an American Doctor Who. And at that point, if that would have taken off, we would have seen Doctor Who become an American franchise. We might not have ever seen the British reboot that has kind of come to define it in the modern era.
And I suspect, by the way, it would not have been nearly as charming if that were like Doctor Who would be like banging the companion. The companion would be basically like a James Bond hottie equivalent. And I think it's probably for the best.
It's not a bad watch. To kind of see, like, all right, in a world where the executives who greenlit X-Files, because I mean, X-Files is a smoldering show in terms of romance. Like, it's not all about, you know, a mm-hmm. TNA. So I think, like,
that's true.
In that world, it could have worked. But anyway, I think that's how I have come to kind of understand it, is that at its best, it's an X-Files show with an element of science fiction on it. But like any X-Files fan will tell you, there's a few clunkers amongst the season. You know, like they're not all amazing monsters of the week.
Right. And that, based on my very cursory experience with it of, you know, 4 to 6 episodes and bits and pieces I've picked up whenever I'm over in the UK, it seems to me that there are these episodes that are exquisitely written. I have great respect now for Stephen Moffat, who's clearly a talented writer with really high abilities to get into, like, time loop stuff, which I think is impressive. There's also, from what I can tell, a very interesting storied, like massive mythology around this entire thing that involves, like, oh, well, that's not the Doctor, that's the long, I can't remember, there's some term for, like, the Dark Doctor, and there's also the Master, which is arch nemesis, and there's all the different Doctor incarnations, and they happen through regeneration, and so all of that appears to be great. But then there's also, like, I've watched a couple episodes where it's like Doctor Who fights the sludge monster, and that's the extent of it. It's just like Doctor Who's running around with a kind of, like, hot high school student, and they shoot arrows at a monster that, like, lives in a dumpster, and, like, that's, like, that occasionally happens. And I started with that, like, that particular thing, and I was like, this is dumb. This is, like, it struck me as like an after school special when I first watched it a couple times, of like, this is clearly for 14-year-olds, and like, yeah, now I'm discovering the better stuff, and I'm like, oh, there's some good stuff here.
So if you are going to critique, and Stephen Moffat, it's very interesting as somebody who has seen Blink, which is by far his opus. Like, that is it does not get better than Blink for Stephen Moffat writing in Doctor Who. I don't think that's a controversial statement.
And I'll say, for anybody that's kind of in the Heaton category here of kind of knowing of Doctor Who but not knowing the terms we're throwing around, the Weeping Angels, which were a very iconic part of Doctor Who, if you go to, like, Comic-Con or anything like that and you see people dressed as Weeping Angels, that's from the episode that we're referencing here, Blink.
Yeah, and basically they are monsters that are basically like the ghosts in Mario, where as soon as you turn away, they advance on you, and then if you turn back, they are
they freeze back into gargoyles.
So it's a very simple but very terrifying premise. What that episode does exceptionally well is that Doctor Who and his companion Martha, I believe, in that season are barely in it. This is a story.
His companion's appears to be a very competent, high-spirited black woman.
Yes,
and they're only showing up basically in old DVD tapes. And the protagonist of the episode is, I think, a woman named Amy Pond, who is like
Amy Pond is a later. She's a later.
My bad. Yeah. It's a lady who in the episode is
Random
named
lady.
Something Sparrow, Shannon Sparrow, or something like that.
Yeah. Here, if you keep explaining, I can, because she's actually a famous actress. Well,
good. So in the episode, as you say, there's these weeping angels that if anybody spots them, they have to stop immediately. And if they spot each other, they'll have to stop immediately because they can't move when anything's spotting them. Hence, they keep their hands over their eyes so that they don't see each other. And they drain life force from people, or rather they feed off of potential energy. So the way this particular episode works is if the angels get a hold of you, they don't kill you. They fling you back randomly in time so that now you're in 1920 or now you're in 1960 instead of 2007 when the episode's happening. And so you're not really dead. Where actually there's a great turn of phrase in the episode where he says it's fascinating. They kill people by making them live to death in a different other time. So like you could have like a full life and stuff. It's just that you're in like 1890. So this is a big inconvenience if you don't have a time machine, and apparently a reasonably large inconvenience even if you do, because the Doctor appears to be trapped in all of this stuff. A couple of the characters in the episode that are side characters that, to my knowledge, we never see again, they have to live these lives. The protagonist's best friend, a woman named Nightingale, is thrust back to 1920, where she apparently lives a full life and gets married and everything, but never goes back to a regular time. All of her friends assume she's dead. And then like she has like a brief flirty thing with a cop who's flung back to 1960. So when she meets him, he's now an old man, and he doesn't get to go back. Which, by the way, why doesn't the Doctor fix all that stuff? This is a question I had. He gets the TARDIS back at the end of the episode. Why doesn't he just grab everybody and go back in time and be like, hey, sorry about that. Okay, how long are you here? 5 minutes? That seems like a nice little trip to 1920. Let me take you back to your time so that your friends and relatives don't think that you got murdered and left at a dumpster someplace.
You've hit on a crucial element of Doctor Who. And by the way, Carey Mulligan is the actress who is in this particular episode, Inside Llewyn Davis, Shame, and most recently A Promising Young Woman. Fantastic actress, and like great, the grand tradition of many fantastic British actors. Everyone eventually stops on to be terrorized by some monster on Doctor Who. But you've hit on something that's very crucial. Doctor Who is science fantasy. And it is, I think, a problem for which if it gets lumped in with Star Trek or even, you know, some other like series for which it might not be hard sci-fi, quote unquote, in the way that we would think of a novel or anything, but something that is far more in the realm of magic than in the realm of engineering.
Right. Then I'm aware that the Doctor has a sonic screwdriver, and that and the TARDIS are really the only two forms of technology I think that we really encounter. It's not a techie show.
And even then, they kind of just do whatever they want. So it's like,
right. Why? He's got a wand that they call a sonic screwdriver.
Basically. Like, why doesn't the Doctor go back and save everybody? For the same reason why in a fantasy show, blood magic can't bring back somebody who's already got the ancient mark. Like, you know, because... Mm, yeah. Reasons, like because magical reasons, but that,
having a plot with no consequences is less fun than having a plot with
consequences. Well, no, but it doesn't mean you don't have consequences in the same way that Game of Thrones was a fantasy show but had consequences, and when people died, it mattered, and that's a problem with where Doctor Who has gone, because at its best in the reboot, death and loss mattered. And that's like it's unfortunate that in the episode that you saw in the season, the first reboot season, that you, I guess, got one of the really cheesy ones, because initially they rebooted the series with this fairly dour concept that the plucky Doctor who wanted to feed you jelly babies in the 70s. Now something horrifying has happened and he is responsible for it on some level. And so the person that we see is somebody that's kind of PTSD'd a little bit. And I think that in a world that is as expansive and as chaotic as Doctor Who, that kind of quote unquote gritty reboot, as much as you would be able to fit that into this narrative, like kind of worked. Like it gave it consequence and weight. So now when he teleports into some village and the sludge monster eats grandma, now it's not just, oh well, let's let's don't worry, we'll figure out how to make a new grandma out of the time putty. Like, it mattered to him because loss mattered to him. And there's a great scene, and this is really where Moffat sort of put his name on the map. But there's a two-parter that is another sort of iconic horror element of Doctor Who, where instead of the Weeping Angels, the iconic villain is a you know, bombing of London era child who has a gas mask on and just keeps asking randomly, "Are you my mummy? Are you my mummy?" And so you take a terrifying moment in time. You have this, like, anytime that children say anything in a scary moment, it's extra terrifying.
Yeah, it's extra creepy.
Extra creepy. But spoiler alert for that two-parter, he finds a way, and this is about five or six episodes into the season, he finds a way to save everybody. And he's, for the first time in that season, elated that, like, everybody was able to live, because this is the first time that there hasn't been an adventure that he's been on where there was actual human consequences that really, like, hurt him. And that, to me, is where the show is at its best. It's always been where it's at its best in this reboot phase. The problem is, like you said, some of this, it became very popular with young girls. It became very popular with, like, the Tumblr sect of the internet. And they like their floppy-haired boys falling down and being cute and making eyes at the companion. And it's like, I think that can still be there. I can still enjoy a show that a 14-year-old girl likes. But, like, I think when you give into that too much, when that becomes the main course and not the side dish, when the consequences aren't the main driving force, the show loses narrative thrust. And that's why I think it does have a earned reputation with folks who have sampled into it and said, like, so what? It's just going to be like a super low rent version of, like, Romancing the Stone or Indiana Jones with less interesting characters.
I'll say on that note, I love Capaldi. I think he's a great actor. I loved him in the Thick of It and in The Loop.
Yeah.
He's a really, really funny
icon.
Which is an
icon.
Unrelated for anybody that hasn't seen either of these wonderful productions. They're very, very funny British political satire, and he plays this foul-mouthed, angry Scotsman that has just some of the most exquisite, like, "Oh, go to hell, you flat-footed barista." Like, it's this weird, like, he'll find these odd portmanteaus and things he'll put together. So I already love that actor. And I like him in Doctor Who, now having watched this episode, because I instinctively dislike young, floppy male stars.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I never got to be that guy, but I could be cool 55-year-old man. That's something that I could be in the future. But I'm definitely not going to be like 28-year-old heartthrob, because I wasn't when I was 28. So
yeah.
Go to hell. I hope you die, boyfriend doctor. Whereas, like, yeah, old dude doctor that's, like, kind of suave and cool and snarky, I'm like, yeah, 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 I like this thing. This is something that appeals to me more.
Yeah, I think Capaldi, going with an older doctor, was a reaction to the idea that, okay, well, coming out of Matt Smith, we're not going, you know, they went from David Tennant, who was a heartthrob, but not.
He strikes me as like the Hugh Grant of doctors. He's kind of like foppish and clumsy, but charming and handsome.
Matt Smith, yes. So it's like, so if you look at, like, the kind of roles that David Tennant has got post Doctor Who, they're, like, if not character actory, then television leading man, where we do a lot of complicated kind of people. Whereas, like, Matt Smith is a very candy coated version of that. Like, they went extra cute, extra goofy with that, with Matt Smith's portrayal, and in a way where it's like Matt Smith can now only play that guy or evil British aristocracy. Like, that's, like,
yeah, I was about to say, didn't he play Prince Philip in The Crown? Isn't that the same guy?
Yes, exactly. And that's, like, the only thing that he can do is those two things, which I assume every actor in England can play evil British aristocracy. I think that's, like, that's, like, the 101 in acting.
It's the first thing they teach at acting camp.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
You're going to be playing a duke. Yeah.
It's just like, do me a favor. Like, and you, and we're practicing withering looks today. Matt, good, extra icy.
Well, actually, granted, we're about 20 minutes in, but just for anybody that's brand new to The Doctor, can you give just a quick synopsis of what the show is? Like, who is the Doctor? Why is he on Earth? Why does he live in a phone booth?
Sure.
And what is he trying to do?
Doctor Who is, well, the Doctor is the main character. There is no Doctor Who, which every once in a while they like to play with, but... the Doctor is a Time Lord, which is a race of aliens that is centered on Gallifrey. Gallifrey, depending on where we are in the series, is either destroyed or not destroyed, or destroyed at some point in time, but not at another point in time. He travels time and space, but has a fascination with Earth. He loves Earth. He loves Earthlings, and he is lonely. And so he often takes companions on his journeys.
And that's not a euphemism. He's not picking up girlfriends. He just has like a sidekick who's usually a woman.
They are
almost like nieces or something.
As a rule, they are not romantic. Now, a hallmark of the reboot series is the companions keep falling in love with the Doctor, which I do think is kind of a pressure from the fan base. But the Doctor does not seek that out. Like, this is a thing that he is genuinely looking to just share his adventures with a race of people that he loves. And he does love the people that he brings along with him. And then from there, you know, we have a gigantic menagerie of iconic villains.
He's got basically a time traveling spaceship, which is the TARDIS.
The TARDIS. And
it looks like a phone booth, but it's bigger on the inside than the outside.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And so it was cloaked as a police box, and he's never been able to figure out how to change it back. That it makes the iconic like sound as it warps through space and time.
Okay, so question that I've actually really been wanting to know about the Doctor and Doctor Who.
Yeah,
I know that we're on like 13th Doctor, I think, at the moment, or maybe the 12th Doctor. I don't know, but we've got a lot of them, right? I get that. When this first started back in like 1969, they went through, or 62, I don't know, in the 60s, they went through several doctors. And when they did that, they went through several actors who portrayed the Doctor. And rather than doing like a James Bond style thing where they just never acknowledged that now Sean Connery's playing him as opposed to this other guy, what they did is, he regenerates. And so when a doctor is particularly damaged, or maybe he just wants a facelift, he regenerates. I did see, I think I saw the death scene for the penultimate doctor, Matt Smith, where he appeared to be very like sad that he was going to renew and he was or regenerate. And he was also very worried about it. And I thought that was interesting because I had always just thought that it was the exact same doctor. It's just that he had a different flesh suit that he donned every once in a while when his old flesh suit got marred. But the implication with Matt Smith was that the doctor has some degree of autonomy and personality, which varies from incarnation to incarnation. And so I got the impression it was almost more like it's a new doctor, but that new doctor just has all of the old doctor's memories. Is it something like that?
Effectively, like it is a different person. Now, that doesn't mean that there is not institutional memory, but a hallmark of a first episode after a regeneration is the doctor getting his or now her wits about them. The big drama that was around that particular regeneration was that I believe, and this is going to hurt my nerd cred if I get this wrong, but there was a prophesized cap of how many regenerations a Time Lord had. And so
it said that they could have 12, and they'd done some like weird shuffling before where they're like, well, the 11th one didn't count because blah 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 blah. Yeah,
no, they've now blown through even their official like doctors, so it's like they had to figure out, oh, well, like, that's only according to the book of blah, blah, blah. The book of the updated version, please update your ebooks and you now can regenerate more. So they made up a reason why it was okay, but that was part of it. They were playing that element that this might be the last life of the Doctor for all it was worth at that point.
Which is a good thing to do whenever you want to juice up viewership, is make it seem like it's not going to go for 400 years, which it clearly is.
Yeah.
Doctor Who's going to last as long as the BBC lasts, which is awesome. I frankly think it's really cool.
It's the greatest renegotiation point in the history of television, right? Or it's like you're doing great, famous actor. Your career is going nowhere but up, and I'm sure you got all these cool directors from Hollywood calling you. We're so proud of you. We think it's great. We're going to pay you $5 to do another 20 episodes. And you're like, oh, and also we're going to get first pick of all your dates. And so, Michael Bay wants to make you the person who saves the day during the crossover with the Fast and the Furious franchise. Man, we really need you to high kick that slug monster, though. So we're going to need you in Cardiff. Oops. And don't worry, it's that $5 will be waiting under your pillow as soon as you go back to the hotel. And it's like, I don't want to do it.
Because you are completely expendable at any given time. We just need you for the episode where you get shot. And even then, if you refuse to do it, we could just have somebody that looks like you from behind get shot.
Exactly. And so I think it is a kind of dance behind the scenes, because British actors specifically, I think, are very, very, very specific about science fiction franchises, which is to say they hate them until they stop working on them and then they like miss them terribly. But yeah, so especially when, you know, these are really good actors, high end actors that have all worked, well past, Doctor Who, all the people who have had a career on Doctor Who have not only worked in England but also America well after they've done it. But it's like, you know, when you're in the TARDIS, you have a real, you know, a heart of science fiction, a part of science fiction's heart.
Well, you're kind of one of my friends refers to the big four in science fiction, which weirdly enough has never been a phrase I've heard before until recently, but he mentioned that Doctor Who's one of them, which I think makes total sense. I think you could argue that Doctor Who's the most successful science fiction series of all time. If we're just talking about gross income and amount of episodes and things like that, maybe Star Trek's outpaced
television?
At least what I read.
Yeah, I mean, I would say
what I've read today says that no, that's not the case. That Doctor Who's actually outpaced it. So if you're rating Doctor Who, it's like you're monarch of a wing of science fiction. You're the figurehead of this massive, massive, massive BBC enterprise. That's got to be fun.
There's never going to be a moment where Doctor Who doesn't matter. It will matter even if it wanes internationally. It will always matter in England. And even now with this back catalog, now that we've entered into a world of like binging and streaming where series like The Office and Friends and everything like have these gigantic lifespans, like for anybody who's just getting into science fiction, there's a 13-year-old that's gonna rip through all of at least the reboot episodes of Doctor Who tomorrow. And it's going to be great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is what they ought to do is they ought to develop like a, rather than a chronological way of binging Doctor Who, I think it would almost make more sense to have like a spiral of just starting with the really, really good episodes, watch those, and then just kind of go out like in a bullseye pattern to the slightly less good. But I still want to see what happened. Like when I watched Heaven Sent, which is the other episode that you recommended to me, the Doctor, by the way, we're going to spoil these episodes for anybody, but they're fun episodes all the same. In this episode, the Doctor is in a kind of prison / confessional like interrogation thing, and he's trapped there for what turns out to be, because he's basically having his memory rebooted ad infinitum, he's trapped there for like a couple million years.
Yeah.
And at the end of the episode, he gets out and sees a city on the horizon, and he basically says, I'm going to grind that into dust. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, I just watched this episode of this guy doing this weird like limbo purgatory version of the Count of Monte Cristo, and he's out now and he's pissed off, and I'm like, I assume that's his home planet and for some reason he's a fugitive, but if not, I'm curious as to who he's gonna kill, and I'm curious as to what the I'm in for the next episode. Like, you've piqued my, like, even though this is a fine standalone product, I do want to see what happens to that bubble city.
Yeah, and I believe that is Gallifrey. And yeah. The Doctor's relationship to Gallifrey is something that is complex, to say the least. But, yeah, man, I here's the problem, though. The problem is that it can often be a repository of garbage writing. Really, really, really bad writing. In fact, if I were to tally up the episodes that I would... If you said all of them, Justin, give me the list of all the good Doctor Who episodes from the reboot, and now I am putting my own reputation for somebody that's not just there to explore it like an artifact, but wants good science fiction or good science fantasy. I mean, maybe I get it up to 10 or 11.
Like, oh, really? Okay.
Like, yeah, it's... Now, hopefully you fall in love with the characters and hopefully you fall in love with some of these arcs and you very much enjoy. The show at its best is when consequences meet the relationship that the Doctor has with the companion. So you get a great monster of the week. You have you are reliant on this dynamic between the Doctor and the companion. And then it actually matters what they're doing. They're not just going into Victorian London so they can fight anthropomorphized smog and then they punch it and then they leave. It's like something is happening that makes you care beyond like a really hacky writery, like, oh no, there's an orphan in a well, like, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Well, and I think that's true for science fiction in general. Like what I mean, I love Star Trek and I consider that my first love when it comes to science fiction. But one of the things that Battlestar Galactica did that Star Trek doesn't typically do in most of the series is it did change from week to week. The characters did die. There were consequences. So you really wanted to see what was going to happen because you got attached to the characters and you knew that they might not die. Whereas like in Star Trek, somebody gets pregnant, so they leave for a month, you know, somebody decides they don't want to do Star Trek anymore, so they die, but it's only because the actor's not game anymore. And it's very procedural where, you know, look at this interesting planet we've beamed down to. What a fascinating, it's almost like Victorian England, where we learned many things on that trip. Let's go to the next planet. And like it just kind of restarts every, which is fine. It's fun for the thought experiment, but it doesn't have that same build of real character. I mean, it does at times because I'm going to get Picard does have that over the course of the movies and things like that. But for the most part, they're procedural. Whereas Doctor Who, I get the impression that sometimes people get screwed over. I'm told that, the companions, sometimes, die or ultimately just get really, I don't know, exhausted of following the Doctor around and then just drop out. And I'm like, yeah, that's interesting.
So, to me, where the show kind of wrote its own course that I was not a gigantic fan of was the first Matt Smith series, which introduced, I thought, a very interesting idea for a companion. And so the idea is Matt Smith shows up and the first thing he does is he randomly, it just like lands in this Scottish yard and this little girl helps him eat pudding, fish sticks and custard. That's what he eats. And so that kind of nurses him back to health. And now she's fascinated by this spaceman that she met when she was a girl. Flash forward, she is now about to get married, but she's having cold feet. She runs back into the Doctor and now she's like, oh, I'll be your companion, with the idea being that she's running away from her marriage, but she's not really, because he has a time machine. And even though she's lived a life, she can now come back and she hopes that adventure after adventure, this will fill her with the kind of satisfaction that she does not feel if she were just to walk to the altar and marry this guy. Now, in a more mature series, which I was hoping it would be, I kind of feel like either, and spoilers for later in the season, the fiance who winds up, you know, getting in the mix, either kind of has to die or
he's a monster, it turns out.
Or she walks away and she realizes that this is not about, I can't just have a bunch of space adventures and have this relationship work. Like, that's not a thing that can happen. This is a problem with the relationship. We should walk away and still be friends or blah, blah, blah. There's a million ways you can go. the season ends with a happy wedding. And it's like, that's where the writing to me, it so often flirts with these very interesting kind of weighty concepts, which I know what some people might say, but that's not Doctor Who. And I would say, no, it is the best Doctor Who because the world is so silly, because eventually you might end up in the planet where all the aliens have square heads, and but they all still talk like British actors. Like there's and maybe you're in Victorian London, maybe you're in prehistoric era, maybe you're in ancient Greece. Like the world is so wacky that the weightier it is, the better it is, which kind of brings me to me, that's kind of why Rick and Morty works. If you look at Rick and Morty as a concept, it's far more like Doctor Who.
Rick has some serious pathos. That is like it's buried there, but it's he's a deeply damaged individual. Quasi-suicidal and clearly an alcoholic. There's some stuff he's dealing with.
I would say it's not quasi-suicidal. It's actively suicidal, and it's not very buried. It's right there. And that's the thing is like when I watch Rick and Morty, I'm like, okay, well, that's a show where they're saying, we know we can go anywhere. And that's obviously, it's a comedic show. So they are going to go to a world where all the people have butts on their faces and they poop through their nose and stuff like that. So you're going to get a wackier, schmackier kind of world. But that idea of the world so big that we need to make the pain real. Because if the pain's real, then everything else that we do matters so much, no matter where we go, no matter if I have to harness a pterodactyl to get down to save this person. If you care about what it means, what getting down to save that thing or do that thing, then lassoing a pterodactyl and flying it around matters. And that's cool. That's great science fiction to me. Like that's what a swashbuckling science fantasy thing should be. And too often, I think, you know, and they kind of take these off ramps either for relationship reasons or just maybe hacky writer reasons that kind of put a cap on where the show has gone in the past.
I like that. It's interesting too in that because the show is immortal, it's not a thing where they're going to mature along with the audience a la Taylor Swift. Like they're having to figure out like what's the target demographic, et cetera, and so forth. But I like that idea of depth to it. The other episode that I watched, Heaven Sent, the aforementioned one where Capaldi playing the Doctor is in this interrogation chamber castle type thing. Like there's some pathos there. Like I was watching and I was like, this is a really good acting episode because I don't think there's anyone who speaks in the entire episode other than him. And one of the things that he's alluding to, and I don't know the backstory on this, is that his companion Clara, who he refers to as his best friend, was like murdered in front of him in a bad way in the previous episode or at some point. And it got me thinking like in Highlander, Sean Connery won't get married anymore because Sean Connery, to completely jump the series, Sean Connery's an immortal. He's been married several times. He's watched multiple wives grow old and die, and he's like, I'm done. I can't put myself through that anymore. I'm not going to do that anymore. And I was like, huh, I wonder if the Doctor gets like a companion fatigue where he's like, I've had 15 companions. They've all died or gotten married or gotten old, and I can't like, you know, like message them. So like it might be necessary for him to do those regenerations, if not physically, just emotionally, so that he can kind of reset and not be bogged down by everything.
So while the most recent series has its flaws, the one thing that I very much have loved is that they took a new direction with the companions. And this time there was three of them. One a young woman, another a young man, and another an older dude. And the older dude is like, every time that they try to drop him off and the Doctor's like, all right, hey, we survived this crazy adventure. Man, that was nuts. He's like, hey, I'm a widower. So like, where's next? Like, I just like, you know, I'm old as hell. I just kind of want to hang out. Like, I just really like it. And he has this kind of old man sense of humor, but I love it. I love that idea. And I just think I wish that they would take more chances like that and to me, this most recent series has sung the most when we're dealing with that, those inner dynamics. It's been the weakest in that, like, among our modern trend of, you cannot make your points, too, obvious. You're either political or socio commentary points. There's like, we're not living in a world where, like, you know, like Sneetches on Beaches with Stars Upon Vars is like way too like, oh yeah, you can't even see this is about racism. It needs to be about black and white things, and they need, and one of them needs to be called Jim Crow. Like there's no room for subtlety in terms of our messaging anymore. And Doctor Who has certainly fallen into that trap where now, you know, if you're going to do a story about a gigantic alien in the ocean that feeds off pollution, it has to end with Doctor Who looking straight into the camera and saying, please recycle. Like,
wait, does that happen? Or are you saying it doesn't do that?
Oh no, it does do that. It does that.
It does do that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
No, they've not been immune to that, which is unfortunate because it gets wrapped up in the fact that we have our first female doctor, Jodie Whittaker, I think is an exceptional actor.
Which I imagine was a whole thing. I don't know. My guess is most people were probably fine with it and excited, but there were probably a bunch of degenerate trolls, and then that created a whole like think piece industry.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate that like that the idea of expanding the fact that, you know, that an alien that regenerates can or can't be a woman gets mixed up with the fact that like the writing, like, and it's not like Doctor Who is alone in this. I think in general, science fiction writing has become a little less and less unsubtle for those who want to make political points. You can probably chart it on like a 20-year history of, you know, like, I think that's what.
Although I'll say from the sci-fi perspective, though, like, I literally was Friday night. One of the questions I like asking people when I'm getting to know them is, if you could switch genders for a limited amount of time, how long would you do it? And would you? And like, and I really enjoy talking to people about that, because like, men and women tend to have very different answers. Women tend to go way longer than men do, and have a lot of reasons to discuss with me of why they would like to do that. And I'm like, great, this is something, because I can't, I would like to know this, right? So that would be a fun thing. Like, I hope that comes up in the new series with Lady Doctor, because like, having someone go, oh, I've been a dude for 12 lifetimes and now I'm dealing with this stuff, like that, I think that would be really interesting, and it might be a way for somebody like me to be able to get into it.
That's there, and I think that is earned by the character. Like that. That's not really what I'm talking about. What I'm more talking about is some of the Monster of the Week stuff, where, you know.
Oh right, no. Where it's just very like in your face, preachy, not like obtuse, not very subtle kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's
rarely cool. Find that fun.
Yeah, it's it is what it is.
Well, tell you what, I'll tell you one more brief thought I have, and then I'd like you to kick off a couple episodes you might recommend for people. Thought I have to go back to the regeneration.
I already gave you my best ones. Let me look up the names of them. But go ahead.
Whatever. Yeah. So one of the things that I enjoy about the concept of regeneration is it kind of reminds me of Buddhism, or at least a school in Buddhism. The sort of cartoonish way of Buddhism portrayed in the United States is that it's just a belief in reincarnation where you're the same person every time. But some of the schools that I've heard, and I suspect that they're more widespread, are the idea that when you die, just kind of components of you float away and get recombined into somebody else. So your karma gets broken apart and it melds with somebody else's karma, and that becomes a person. So it is to say that it's a different person, but they inherit all the bad and good stuff that happened just kind of by chance. And then same thing, like certain memories might get reincorporated, even though they're not necessarily yours. You're a new person, but you're this combination of memories from other people in the same way that you're genetically a combination of egg and sperm. And I'm like, so regeneration was very interesting to me, of the idea that there could be a unique character that's like half the same and half different, kind of like a Trill in Star Trek. Like, I find that interesting, where it's not a completely different person. It's not a completely new person, but it's some sort of intermediate state that changes. And I find that interesting. And so I'm curious to explore that in the future. Okay.
Yeah.
That's my bit. Justin, the two episodes you started me out on, which I do recommend, are Blink, which has David Tennant in it, although he is less of a role than the female protagonist, as we mentioned, which means, by the way, that if you don't know anything about Doctor Who, you don't need to know anything about Doctor Who. And Heaven Sent, which is this Capaldi stuck in a time castle episode. Are there any others that you'd like to point people to that might want to get into the series?
So I'll recommend the two-parter from the reboot, the first season of the reboot, The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances. That is in the World War II British air raid era. And that is the Are You My Mummy creepy little kid. It was the high water mark for Moffat before he wrote Blink. So if you like Blink, then you will like these two. And also, I think it's probably a better introduction into the world of the first season. The first episode is a little wackety schmackety, but this gets you kind of a lot of that pathos, that like the doctor's pathos, and then you know, kind of getting a level of exuberation. I already spoiled it for you if you listen to it, but it is interesting to watch, and it shows you a little bit more of the kind of larger universe that that Doctor Who kind of brought, which includes Captain Jack Harkness, which eventually got his own spinoff with Torchwood.
I'm just keen to watch Capaldi gallivanting around with an old funny widower. That actually sounds like speed.
No. That the funny widower is Jodie Whittaker. So that's the most recent season.
Oh, really? Okay, cool. Yeah. I'll watch. That sounds I like that. Again, I like the main characters that I'm like, oh, I can be that guy. Yeah. I got a role in this world.
No, that I'll have to find I don't know. I once did a Doctor Who podcast called Who's the Boss.
That's what I thought. Didn't you host a Doctor Who podcast at one point?
I had to stop doing it because I would criticize it too much. Former guest on this show, Andrew Main, once wisely explained to me about nerd and fan culture that there are people that are, especially with nerd stuff, where we're old enough to remember that there was a time where nerd things didn't last. They didn't exist. When they happened, they would go away really fast. They would often suck, but they were rare. They were a treat, a thing that would happen and then go away. Now it's abundance. Like we get reboots spinoffs on reboots. We win, right? Forever.
Yeah, we
but
won.
But there is an element that is hard-coded, I believe, into nerd culture, that if you talk bad about a thing, it might go away. You're part of the reason that it went away because you pointed out that this episode was poorly written, or you pointed out that this showrunner sucks. And that's why I had to stop talking about it, because I just started pointing out that Moffat only has one female character that he writes over and over and over again. They're big, brassy,
gritty, surprised 21-year-old. Those are all really salient points that, like, I noticed, like when I was in high school, watching old films about nerd was not a thing to aspire to. Nerd was a derogatory term. And I feel very defensive about this because I'll talk to people. I talked to somebody a couple of years ago, and he was discussing like basketball, and he's like, sorry, I apologize, I'm a basketball nerd. And I was like, shut your mouth. You're not a nerd because you like basketball. In high school, you were dating a cheerleader. I was building one. I get to say nerd. You don't get to say nerd. I really like bread. I'm a bread nerd. Shut up. Like, nerd has become, I'm quirky and I'm more intelligent than other people. That's what nerd means now. And I'm like, no, I actually get into this stuff. I'll say the flip side of what you described, though, Justin, of the criticism thing. I find that science fiction fans tend to become very overcritical, and I think that I'm gonna I'm going to hold back here. I think people that don't make anything and never plan to make anything are very quick to criticize things because it gives them a sense of satisfaction of like, yeah, I didn't make a thing, but I can point out the bad things. And it's one of the things that I do on this program where I've had lots of my friends that have called me and be like, hey, I really want to come on and discuss how horrible the prequels are or whatever. And I'm always like, we can literally talk about anything in the entire world that you like. Literally anything in the world that you like, and you want to come on the show just to talk about stuff you hate? Why would you do that with your time? And so I intentionally try and shepherd it towards positive things.
Yeah, I will always love Doctor Who. I'll always watch Doctor Who because I do love the premise, and I think it's a series that intentionally can always go in the right direction. Like, there's rarely been a season that I've watched, and I haven't liked, you know, an episode or two, right? Mm-hmm. That I very much enjoyed. So I don't know. I think it is. It's an exceptional franchise, and if you can get over some things, you know, it's always a good watch. And I'm glad that you got to watch those two episodes specifically, because I do think that when it's good sci-fi, it's great sci-fi, and it's one of the rare, if we're talking about the grand franchises in television science fiction, it's one of the few that can do horror. Like, Doctor Who can do horror in a way that no other science fiction really is built to do. And some of the best episodes are straight out what's behind the door horror episodes.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, I enjoyed talking to you about this. I'm glad that you've properly framed Doctor Who for me as I explore it and begin this next phase of my life. Justin Robert Young, thank you.
Thank you very much, good sir.
That's the show. Thank you, Justin Robert Young, for coming on to talk about Doctor Who. Thank you, media assistant Eric Stipe, who edited today's program. Until next time, tally-ho!